be nice to talk to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming to the Joint Aviation Subcommittee between the House and Senate Aviation Subcommittees. I know this is a joint meeting, and I've been kind of holding on for our co-chair, who is, of course, enormously popular because she also does things with taxes, and people are always looking for her valuable time and counsel. So if you'll indulge me, I'd like to get the program started because we do have a few housekeeping items we can wander through here before we start into some testimony. And I'm looking for my working agenda right here. Representative Larson and Ruth are excused this morning. There are a couple of announcements I'd like to make. To my right, your left, is Mr. John Williams, who's been here, I think, since internal combustion engine was invented. He's been our House nonpartisan researcher for excellent service for 37 years. He is retiring. This afternoon, if you're in this building between 2 and 4 o'clock, your attendance is required in the library, where a huge party is taking place in honor of John Williams. So please come on up. Yes, a round of applause. Mr. Williams, we appreciate you putting up with us for all these years and making many of us look much better and smarter than we deserve to. Thanks for doing that. And if you'd pass along how you did that to your follower, your mentoree, Matt Burris, who's sitting right next to Mr. Williams. Matt will be following on Mr. Williams' spot and will be our transportation researcher that will be drafting some legislation, answering our questions, and doing other research that we need as we move ahead with legislative things. Matt, welcome to the fray. We're glad you're here. The next meeting of the House Transportation Committee is on Wednesday, March 8th. Meeting times for this legislative session will be the same as last year's. They will be Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 2:15 in Room 10. Now, we don't have a lot of meetings between the time we start the legislative session and the time the committee deadlines hit. So we need to be paying attention that Tuesdays and Wednesdays, House Transportation Policy Committee meets at 2:15 at Room 10. And those House members that are here today, there's a little blue sheet in your file. Be sure you turn that into Margaret after the meeting. It seemed to me there was one more thing I wanted to comment on. Oh, yes. Mr. Ray Rott was going to be with us today, the Director of Aeronautics. I did get a voicemail message that I believe was from Ray this morning. It was really hard to tell because his voice sounded so terrible. He said he couldn't be here. I called him back and thanked him for not being here. He sounded infectious, so I'm glad that he's not here. However, Mr. Mike Lewis from the Office of Aeronautics has joined us, along with several supporting members behind him in case we have questions. And so, Mr. Lewis, I think at this time... No, hold on. We got a couple more things we can do while we're stalling for Senator Rest.
Thank you.
I'm informed that we do have a quorum, so we can pass judgment on the minutes of the last two meetings. March 7, 2005, January 31st, 2006, were the last time we had joint aviation meetings. If someone would like to move those minutes or discuss them, we could do that. Otherwise, Mr. Leader, Representative Leader.
Mr. Chair, I did read them, and I move to accept the minutes.
Representative Leader moves the minutes. Further discussion? Seeing none, let's vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Senator Reth, excuse me. We're glad you're here. It's your turn to swing the gavel.
I'm sorry.
And I've taken this to this point right here. We're about ready to have Mr. Lewis launch into his presentation.
Thank you, Chair Beard, and welcome to this joint subcommittee meeting, Mr. Lewis, and we're really happy to have your presentation this morning. If you'd like to begin.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chairman Beard and Madam Chair Rest. It's very good.
You need to move the mic either closer or if it's on or for us to hear you as well as for the tape.
How's that? Is that a little better?
It's better.
Okay. Certainly a pleasure to be here and a belated happy Valentine's Day greeting. As Representative Beard said, Ray Rott is unable to be here. He wanted to be here. So I will summarize the comments that he was going to make. He was going to give us a short status report on the national initiatives that are now going on to look at airport land use compatibility issues. So if I can just get into the presentation. And we do have a full contingency here from our planning staff. So depending upon what kind of questions, please challenge us if you will. And we feel that we're in place to respond to them. Three things that I'd like to talk about here briefly. The national perspective that I mentioned. The purpose of the airport zoning consultant that the Office of Aeronautics hired. And a little bit about that. And then we'll end the presentation looking at those recommendations that the zoning consultant has provided. That process is not complete yet. We anticipate our final advisory committee meeting with the zoning consultants on April 5th, tentatively scheduled at this time, and we're hoping to be able to wrap up that process then. And then what I'd like to do is, again, briefly take a look at the significant changes in Minnesota airport zoning statutes and just to be able to identify how those changes have evolved over time since the early 40s. And then to go through the zoning consultant recommendations. The national perspective, the recent airports bill, the Vision 100 legislation, the aviation funding bill that was passed by Congress, it did have a component, Title I, Airport and Airway Improvement Section, and the statement requires compatible land use planning and projects by the state and local government. So that basic initiative was in that bill. And then one of the efforts that I'll talk about included a survey of all the states. The survey was conducted through the National Aviation, State Aviation Officials Group. And they surveyed all the states to get that background information. And as we can see, 95% of the respondents identified a moderate or high concern about land compatibility around airports. So this certainly is not just a Minnesota issue. On average, less than 5% of the national aviation system is being protected 80 to 100% of the time. There's growing concern. And in one FAA report, I remember, they identified that over the past 20 years, the national airport system has lost, on average, one airport a week. So it's certainly an escalating issue that the states are very interested in having some national legislation looking at that issue. The first initiative is a partnership between the American Planning Association and the FAA. They are currently looking at revising the current model ordinance that the FAA has written, that is to limit height of objects around airports. They're looking at that to add information addressing compatible airspace and land use around the airport. So that is one effort that's going on. Second initiative is a partnership between the FAA and NASAO, the National Association of State Aviation Officials, Memorandum of Understanding. And their goals are to protect the national airport system, to meet national aviation demand, and to do that with airports and their neighbors. So it's looking at that broader picture, and that's a very large effort. And the most recent news we received within the last week, the Transportation Research Board identified all their research projects for the next couple of years. And one that we're very pleased with, assessing the impacts of incompatible land uses near airports. That was just selected, as I mentioned, and it's a $500,000 grant. Specifically looking at land use encroachment around airports, particularly off the ends of the runways. And the goal is to provide a basis for suggested zoning rules to protect the public investment in airports. And maybe this is a point to say that now with Ray not here, he probably wouldn't have spoken about his detailed involvement in both the NASAO organization and as a member of a Transportation Research Board. And those two issues were suggested by Mr. Rott. Now, how are other states dealing with this issue right now? And this is a short list, but it certainly identifies that several states are using somewhat different approaches to deal with those airport zoning issues in their states. Wisconsin was the most recent one. They just came out with a very comprehensive study that's resulted in, among other things, a land use compatibility manual. California has probably been in this the earliest, going back to 1992 when they commissioned an airport accident study and provided documentation on national and international accidents to help identify where accidents occur and then what's the implication for airport protection. The airport zoning consultant was hired by the MnDOT Office of Aeronautics to take a hard look at both national zoning rules and laws and procedures, whatever the different states had, and then also to take a hard look at Minnesota's zoning requirements that we currently have in place, with the idea to identify weak spots, inconsistencies. Can our system in Minnesota be made to work better? Is it necessary? How does it compare on a national level? And then we ask them to identify best practices for us as good examples we can offer our clients around the state in putting together the strongest possible ordinance to help the owners of the airports protect their airports and their communities. So, this first picture is a picture of Midway Airport in Illinois. It's hopefully what we don't want to end up with in Minnesota. As you can see, there are houses completely surrounding the airport. And this was the site of a recent publicized accident in December. Southwest flight landed in a 7-inch snowstorm and slid off the end of the runway, the northwest corner, and through the barrier, and then hit some vehicles on the ground. I felt this was an interesting sample to bring up. Accidents do happen, but beyond that, this is a fairly typical accident in that it involved a combination of the three largest or three most common reasons for aviation accidents. It's a combination of pilot error, weather, and also a mechanical problem. And that's fairly typical in that a combination of two or three of those things come together in order to result in an accident. Like I said, a 7-inch snowfall. The pilot had requested to use the alternative runway, but air traffic control felt it would back up too much traffic at O'Hare. The pilot had the choice. The pilot makes the final decision. They decided to land anyway. After working out their landing calculations on a laptop in the airplane and determining that they could safely land using the thrust reversers, the reverse on an airplane, to help it slow down. The mechanical problem was they were unable to engage the thrust reversers for, I read, 18 seconds. That would have helped them ideally slow down in time not to go out the end of the runway. So it's an example of what preferably we would not like to see in Minnesota. The history of the statutory changes, basically the first statutes were passed in 1944 that identified airport zoning requirements based upon the National Airport Zoning Enabling Act that was developed on a national level in cooperation with Municipal Attorneys League. I probably don't have that name right, but So it was developed in cooperation with the potential owners of airports. And that ordinance, a model ordinance, was developed in Minnesota in 1946. The first airport zoning requirements were for airspace protection only. And we'll look at a picture of that a little bit later. So that was Minnesota's entry into protecting airports. In 1952, President Truman called together what was called the President's Commission on Airports. He asked his good friend, General Doolittle, to chair that. And that was an extremely comprehensive process, resulting in a 116-page report, including 20-some recommendations. That report is on our website, a very interesting reading. But two of the recommendations that came out of that report are probably most important. One of them was a recommendation for a runway protection zone off the end of the runway, and that recommendation was adopted by the FAA. It's called the runway protection zone. The second recommendation that is worth mentioning, actually there's two more. One was suggesting that the airport zoning protections should be incorporated within the municipal planning efforts to identify that airports are a part of a larger community, which is still worthwhile noting today. And the third recommendation was for state and local development, implementation, and enforcement of airport zoning rules. And that provided the basis for what Minnesota adopted in 1959. It basically called for land use zoning to extend 2 miles off the end of the runway, very briefly. So that is the basis for our zones. And then in 1959, Minnesota came back and passed legislation that identified land use zoning requirements around airports in Minnesota, that identified zone A, B, C, and D. A and B are the protection zones extending off the runway ends. C is airspace protections around the airport, and then D was an additional airspace protection zone to provide that absence of obstructions as aircraft were circling the airport in the pattern. It also started to identify our incompatible and compatible land uses in Minnesota. In 69, there were some brief modifications to the statutes that changed the classification of airports, and that changed some of the requirements for some of the levels of airports in Minnesota. In 73, there was additional legislation that identified that federal and state funding is contingent upon the airports being zoned. And then in 74, there were some modifications to zoning that removed zone D, I think, was removed. Zone C was changed somewhat. And then the runway protection areas, zones A and B, were made to correspond to the length of the runway rather than being 2 miles. And
Mr. Lewis, did you say that was in the 1974 modifications that A and B was changed?
Changed to be the same as the length of the runway.
Okay, thank you.
And the trade-off there was it was seen as being a lot more economical for the smaller airports around the state that had smaller runways. Before then, they were obligated to protect the same amount of land. The trade-off to that was it made it more difficult for the smaller airports to grow. And it meant at a later date, when they were ready to grow, there were additional requirements to acquire more land. So that was that change. And then in 78, we had legislation passed that provided the existing residential neighborhood exception where if it was felt by the community that losing a good portion of their local community would provide too many social and economic impacts, those structures were allowed to stay, and they would not be identified as non-conforming uses. So that happened in 78. And then the last significant change, the exception, the addition of the exception flexibility clause that identified that social economic trade-off. So with that, just a couple of pictures to show the changes. This was 46. In white, that was the entire area around the airport, providing some protection from obstructions. And then the approach zones were identified, but they were only for towers and buildings that would interfere with the flight paths into the runway. In 59, this is where the land use legislation was added. The gray area, identified as the 1946 turning zone, that was dropped from the requirements. Zones D was still there, and zone C, but much smaller than originally. And zone A and B were identified, the approach zones for the runway, in our typical example, which in this case is 3,000 feet. Zone A was 1 mile or a mile and a half, depending upon the size of the airport. And then zone B went out to that 2 miles identified previously. Zone C was shortened quite a bit to be a half mile from the airport. And then zone D went out an additional mile for airspace obstructions. The restrictions that were identified included no residences within Zone A. It identified a minimum of 5-acre lots in Zone B. And then Zone C included a minimum of 1-acre lots for residential development. Then in 74, there were some additional adjustments there. That's when the length of the zones were made to be consistent with the runway length. So that shortened that area of protection quite a bit. The regulations, no residence requirement still was maintained for Zone A. Some additional language about preventing the assembly of people or congregations of people that affected other types of developments. The Zone B requirements were reduced to 3-acre minimum lot size. And then Zone C only held the general restrictions that include interference with the pilot's ability to safely use the airport, lighting interference, smoke plumes, electronic interference, those types of general restrictions. And then the last part, that's the end of the PowerPoint presentation. The other handout then, identified with the blue cover, that contains a summary of the recommendations of the zoning consultant that almost the entirety of the information has already been presented to the advisory committee as a part of that zoning consultant process. You'll note on the front cover that a note to remind us that this document and the zoning consultant reports are still in their draft form. We haven't completed the process yet, and the information and recommendations have not been reviewed by MnDOT. And we feel that we need to continue our close partnership with the Association of Minnesota Counties and the League of Cities in reviewing any recommendations for changes with them. They have been a part of every change that has been made going back to 44. I did find a copy of the original model ordinance, and that identified that it was prepared by the Minnesota municipalities and counties. So it's a very interesting historical document that we found. But we We would like to continue that process of review.
Excuse me, Mr. Woods. Representative Beard had either a comment or a question.
Yeah, just a comment maybe for our colleagues on the panel here and members in the council or on the audience. Senator Rest and I sit on the Land Use Planning Task Force that's being led by the Department of Aeronautics and the Clarion Associates, who are helping us design this document. There will be some, I think, pretty good recommendations for legislative change. Probably not, like 95% certainly not in this session, but after the next session convenes, there will be some recommendations coming forward, and we're going to be taking this up probably first in this committee, then in transportation policy in the House and however in the Senate. So know that this is a draft document. There's an enormous amount of very skilled work going into it, and there probably won't be action this time, but there will be next time. So if Mr. Lewis doesn't want to go into great detail today, that's certainly understandable. It is a draft document. It is an ongoing process, and we have another meeting, I think, April 5th, did I understand, Mr. Lewis?
Right.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Lewis, I wasn't sure whether you were taking questions as you go in terms of your PowerPoint or we're saving those for later. I don't know.
Representative Hornstein, go right ahead.
I had just a question on that Midway Airport case study that you did. And I seem to recall that some airports have been installing some sort of safety strips at the end of the runways to prevent this kind of thing, and MSP has it, but Midway doesn't. And what's the status of that in terms of airports in Minnesota? I mean, am I understanding this correctly, that there is some sort of safety mechanism to prevent that kind of accident at the end of certain runways?
Mr. Lewis.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and Senator Ornstein. There is a technique. It's nicknamed EMAS, I believe. And it's a safety addition to airports that have runways that that could be considered short under some type of operations. It's a crushable concrete material, is my understanding, is designed when an airplane goes off the end of the regular paved surface, that it goes into this area, the concrete crushes and slows down that aircraft. And if there was this kind of situation in effect at Midway, it would probably have slowed that airplane down to prevent it to go off airport property. It's similar in thinking to a truck runaway zone in the mountains, where a truck can choose to go into a sand pit, more or less. It's a similar concept, and it does work very well. I think there are also plans to develop that as a part of the St. Paul airport improvements. But they are in place at MSP. There are a number of airports around the country that don't have these facilities in place yet. They're quite expensive, but certainly the FAA has been encouraged to encourage that installation as soon as possible.
Representative Weinstein.
Very quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know this, you know, maybe it is very much related to land use and zoning, although it's probably more of a safety issue for categorizing this. But I'm wondering just, in this process, if we could have some sort of assessment of, you know, where this is in place in Minnesota airports, where it may need to be in place, and what some of the costs would be, because it does seem like while you mentioned that it's, it could be considered expensive, it seems like it is effective. And while I would advocate, you know, looking at a broader safety zone, you know, in terms of the land use and zoning, this seems like a simple thing that, you know, could prevent you know, a lot of problems. So I don't know if that's, you know, part of what's in here or something that you're considering in another sphere, but, you know, I think it makes common sense.
Thank you. Anyone else have a comment or question of Mr. Lewis at this time on his presentation? Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Lewis, on the Midway accident, where the plane flew through, how far did it go beyond the A zone into the B zone, or through the B zone into the C zone, or what happened?
No, Midway Airport doesn't have any safety zones around the airport. I think the runway was 6,500 feet, and I think the airplane slid another 1,000 feet or so to the airport barrier. It's a very short situation. The types of protections that we were just talking about are intended for situations that don't have that any open space off the end of the airport. I used that example as something that we can provide, we can prevent by providing those safety zones by through good land use planning around the airport, so that we at some point are not required to build in very expensive short gap methods like the EMAS system.
Follow up,
Stevenson.
And just, do we have any airports currently, either outlying or part of the metro, that do not have adequate safety zones?
Mr. Lewis.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In our outstate airport system, we don't have a situation that would be in any way comparable to what we see at Midway Airport. We do have, in my opinion, very good protection around our existing airports right now through good airport zoning and land use planning with the communities. It would be the metro area that may have the potential to add more than they already had in place.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Mr. Lewis, we hear a lot about eminent domain probabilities are being changing now in nationally and locally. Is that a concern? Is that a would that have a direct effect on some of this land use and planning that you're doing?
Mr. Lewis?
Chair, Representative Leader. I don't see any direct connection to that. I think our present airport development process is firmly established. If there are properties that have existing uses that would not be compatible with airports, the communities are required to acquire them. Zoning is a tool that is meant to be preventive and not corrective. Like I said, if there are properties that are needed for the safe operation or expansion of an airport, that property must be acquired. And in the case where we have, even in zoning, where the impacts of zoning would so reduce the value of that property, acquisition or at a minimum the acquisition of easements would be necessary. So I don't see that discussion having a direct impact on airport protection.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lewis, in your PowerPoint presentation on, I believe it's number 9, you address states, other states addressing the issue of compatible land use situations. And the bottom one, that shows Michigan, manageable protection plans in place, but no guidance. And I'm just kind of threw me off guard as to, isn't the FAA, isn't there some federal guidelines that give the states some kind of guidance or something? And it says no guidance. I'm going, well, what's going on?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, states handle this very, very differently from one state to another. There certainly are some basic FAA requirements in place. However, the FAA is restricted by the basic authority they have. Their authority does not extend off of airport property other than airspace protection for the runway protection zones if that area extends off property. When Congress set up the national system in the Air Commerce Act of 1926, they specifically limited the authority of the FAA and left the responsibility to control land use around airports to the states and the local authorities. So that's why we so desperately need that partnership in place. We certainly work very closely with the FAA, but we work a lot closer with not only the owners of the airports, whether it's the county or city, but also the adjacent communities that are affected by the safety zone requirements.
Hmm. Interesting.
Representative Beard?
Madam Chair, yeah, thank you. Just an observation on that for our panel members. As we talk about zoning, remember that we're in a, from an aviation perspective, we're in a pretty great situation here in the Midwest where the land is flat as far as you can see. But when the national government was setting this up, remember that most of them are from the east where the land is really lumpy, and putting a runway was a matter of putting it where you could get three or 4,000 feet of flat land. And it, if there was a residential development off of one corner of the runway, well, it was tough because there were hills and valleys everywhere else. So that there was no national requirements or guidance on this is certainly understandable. We realize that our situation is really pretty unique. Not unique. It's desirable because the land is flat here and we have land to burn. But when you get other parts of the country where land is much more precious, sometimes you kind of have to make work with what you have. And I noticed that there was a comment made too, back to Representative Stevenson's point. The addition of the existing residential neighborhood exception, you know, some of these airports grew up and the neighborhoods grew up around them back in the days when people were convinced that aviation was the golden age and they were proud to live next to an airport and didn't mind living right next to the airport fence. And now here we are in these days when planes have gotten bigger, heavier, faster, and louder, and not everybody's enamored with the idea of airplanes flying by, but we had to make some exceptions to for certain airports that are kind of already grandfathered into the process, which we still have the runway protection zone issue to deal with, but sometimes we've had to give local municipalities, and Mr. Lewis, correct me if I'm running too far with this, but there had to be some wiggle room in there for existing situations that might not have been workable otherwise. And before you and I got here, there was a huge debate about this in the dual-track airport process, and somehow the legislature settled down on keeping it where it was, and by golly, we're going to make the existing neighborhoods work somehow, so... Just an observation. There is another gentleman coming up in a moment, Mr. Ray Scraggy, who can maybe speak a little more freely about some of those things, if that can help shed light on the discussion. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment prompted by, I think, Representative Beard's, you know, insights about the land, the flat land and the land use around here. And this has concerned me since that incident in Toronto over the summer with the Air France flight, and I think the issue there was it went off into some sort of ravine or low space, and it just had gotten me thinking about, you know, if we had an incident where, you know, maybe we had a heavy jet, an Airbus or something, landing on that runway going into the, heading south, southeast approach into Minneapolis, you know, with that flight that potentially wound up in the, you know, Minnesota River Valley. And again, there's not much I think we can do land use wise. You can't just move the runway or reroute the highway or whatever. But, you know, are there other examples in Minnesota where we do have, you know, topography like that, which could potentially be, you know, problematic around airports?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do have some examples of airport, primarily northern Minnesota. Tower comes to mind, where the runway was pretty much squeezed in. In other areas, we also have lots of examples of surrounding lakes. We tend to have a lot of lakes in Minnesota that can be a part of a runway protection area, but we do have some examples, certainly not like the Alaskan airports or Montana. And they have some real challenges in fitting in airports. And I think as Representative Beard mentioned, we do have challenges in that airports tended to be primarily located near municipal areas, and those communities tend to keep on growing. The airports attract development, and that further complicates the situation. So there are challenges, and when we go out and work with the airports as they're looking at expansion and then modifying their airport zoning ordinance, we find that we have to look at everything. It's certainly not a hard and fast application of any rule. We have to look at what's there and what we have to work with, and what's the best result we can end up with to protect the airport, and then to assist the communities to protect their citizens. So there is a lot of flexibility built into this, and we have several factors that we have to take in mind as we deal with individual issues.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Lewis, for your presentation. I appreciate the work that you do and your public service.
Okay, thank you.
We have also some folks that are listed under a public comment section today, and I would like to first of all invite Mr. Bill Cole, who is the St. Cloud Airport Manager, to come forward and give us his comments. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the Joint Subcommittee meeting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Senator West, Representative Beard, and members of the Joint House and Senate Transportation Subcommittee on Aeronautics. I am Bill Fowler, and thank you for your generous invitation to participate in today's hearing. I am here today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Airports and as the director of the St. Cloud Regional Airport to testify on the subject of airport zoning and share experiences the St. Cloud Regional Airport has had in this regard. The St. Cloud Regional Airport lies in a unique location. It is an island of city property within Haven Township in Sherburne County. Other surrounding jurisdictions include Benton County, Minden Township, and the city of Sauk Rapids to the north, and Stearns County and the city of St. Cloud to the west. The fact that the airport affects a multi-jurisdictional area makes it difficult to preserve the needs of the airport without effective zoning that is adopted by all jurisdictions. In 1976, the city of St. Cloud, Benton, Sherburne, and Stearns counties joint airport zoning board adopted the St. Cloud Municipal Airport Zoning Ordinance. This has been an extremely effective tool in maintaining the safety zones of the St. Cloud Regional Airport. However, development is now encroaching on the airport at the same time the airport is planning for expansion. The current zoning ordinance does not yet cover this future expansion. In concept, the process to enact and enforce airport zoning should work well at airports across the state. However, issues arise as the result of differing economic interests and unique characteristics of airports, their sponsoring jurisdiction, and the communities that surround them. Pressures from jurisdictions located adjacent to airports desiring to enhance the local tax base can threaten the effectiveness of the zoning ordinance and can often lead to conflict between the airport and neighboring communities. In St. Cloud's case, we've been fortunate that zoning has been effective to this point. Other growth is now on the horizon, and with it is the idea of developing areas in close proximity to the airport. Toward that end, the St. Cloud Regional Airport is undertaking an update to our master plan that should be in completed draft form by the end of March. The conundrum we face is allowing the airport to develop and grow to accommodate the growth of the community. If effective zoning and land acquisition does not take place, the airport will be unable to grow, and this will eventually stifle future growth of the St. Cloud region and central Minnesota. Counties and townships have their eye on tax revenues that might come from new development as the St. Cloud region continues to grow and are looking at open space land located close to the airport that has been identified in the master plan as land needed for expansion. As I stated, we are in the process of updating our master plan after an air service study initiated by MnDOT Aeronautics concluded that St. Cloud Regional Airport is the likely future reliever to Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, and an alternate airport if aircraft are unable to land at MSP. The master plan is looking 20 years out, and it is apparent that the main and crosswind runway will need to be extended, along with the construction of a future parallel runway to accommodate this future growth. Additional land acquisition and zoning will be necessary to allow this to happen and should take place in the near future while the land is still zoned agricultural and before the airport becomes surrounded by residential and commercial property that would have to be purchased. Much of the zoning and land acquisition that will need to occur is located south of the airport, where it is currently zoned agricultural. As I speak before you today, residents of Haven Township have applied for rezoning of their land from agricultural to commercial in areas where the airport plans to expand to the south, which could possibly allow for incompatible land uses. If this occurs, both the community and the airport lose, since it takes a tremendous amount of federal, state, and local dollars to rectify the situation. Oftentimes, the cost of fixing a problem like this is too great, and the airport fails to reach its potential. Airport zoning boards need to stand firm and not allow variances in zones A and B. And in the case of St. Cloud, they need to realize that a master plan study is in progress and hold off on any development around the airport until the plan is complete and the ultimate footprint of the airport is determined. Airport managers also need to do a better job of effectively communicating the positive impacts the airport brings to the area and encourage neighboring city and county administrators to implement airport zoning overlays into their planning documents. Yes, zoning can be an effective tool if all area jurisdictions are working together toward one common goal. As I mentioned earlier, the City of St. Cloud will be pursuing a combination of land acquisition and zoning for future airport development. A best-case scenario would be to purchase all the land needed to satisfy state zones A and B, so the airport would have greater control of the land beneath these zones. This would require a substantial investment, but one that would be well worth it in order to protect the long-term interests of the airport. This is one of many ways that the $15 million that was borrowed from the State Airports Fund might be used effectively for airports around the state. This scenario is certainly not unique to St. Cloud, but St. Cloud's issues will differ slightly from those at other airports. For example, many airports may not have the ability, as St. Cloud does, to purchase open space for future development. For airports that have lots of development already around the airport, other solutions may be needed than simply purchasing land. As I'm sure you've heard, when you see one airport, you've seen one airport. Each airport is different, and things like size, growth rate, and economic climate need to be determined to come up with the best solution for that particular airport. So, at first blush, the cookie-cutter approach does not seem to be the answer, but rather flexible zoning approach that takes into account the existing characteristics of that airport. In conclusion, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come before you today to speak about zoning as it relates to the St. Cloud Regional Airport. And we, as airport managers, like you, serve the public interest, and we look forward to working with you on this and other issues of local and statewide importance. Thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have at this time.
Or did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I'll defer to the chair.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. On page 4, Mr. Toler, your comments about the good folks of Haven Township applying for rezoning their land, it makes me think about the comment Representative Leader made a few moments ago. Now we're getting into eminent domain issues, aren't we? Where they have land that they'd like to see accelerate to its highest and best use, but we also have an airport master plan, which is a little different than the RPZ or the A and B, protecting the ends of the runway. You're talking about a future plan to build a whole new runway, which is now running up against their desire to enhance the property, their value of the property, take the money and retire, whatever they want to do with it. And I don't know that you have an answer to this, Bill, but it's important that we know that eminent domain is not going to be a simple discussion, because now we're talking about future government public use of property impinging on somebody's property right now that wants to enhance it. And I don't know that there's a question in here. I just want to make sure that this flag is waved and we know that this is a serious discussion without an easy answer.
Mr. Tall, do you have a comment on Representative Beard's observation?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard is correct that it is certainly possible that eminent domain may come into play during the land acquisition process. There are quite a few willing sellers right now south of the airport, and that's a good thing. However, those willing sellers are also the ones that are looking to rezone their land and ultimately good, bad, or indifferent, they will get, they want to get the most money for their land, and I would agree with them. However, it is zoned agricultural as we speak, and if the other local jurisdictions would allow the master plan to be completed and not rezone that land, it seems a little bit odd to me that that one jurisdiction would rezone something just so it would cost more for another government agency to purchase it.
Madam Chair,
Representative Beard.
If I may, Mr. Trolden, what we have in effect is a taking. If Haven Township would play along with the airport board and say, no, there's going to be a new runway there maybe 20 years from now, you can't rezone your property, haven't we in effect then taken some value from them?
Mr. Powell?
Madam Chair, I don't have an answer for that.
I think it would be a lawyer's full employment act is what it sounds like we're getting. Yeah, I think that members we have a real issue with impinging on the value of somebody's property now because we want to use it at a future date, and somehow government money has to change hands here to compensate them. Maybe that's as far as I want to go with this today, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Steverson.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Tao, just piggybacking, I got a few points that I wanted to speak to on this issue. And I guess the question I have for Mr. Tao here is, when the officials came forth to do the rezoning to a commercial, had they already seen the 20-year plan for the airport?
Mr. Tao?
Madam Chair, Representative Steverson, they are well aware of the master plan. They are they have been involved with the process, both from Haven Township and Sherburne County. So it was, I guess I would say it was surprising to us that that they decided to do that, and maybe ironic in a way that the only land that is being applied for rezoning at this time is land that would sit within the ultimate footprint of the runway.
Representative Steverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Tao. And I guess the question I would have, did they present to you any proposals for an industrial park or anything that they thought would be justifiable for commercial use in that area?
Mr. Tao.
Madam Chair and Representative Steverson, no, they have not. And in fact, I was able to procure some letters from the mayor of St. Cloud and city planners, city engineers, that talks about not having any water or utility services that will be going out or plan to go out into those areas for quite some time, which in effect doesn't make that a real good use for that land. In essence, you're looking at and in a commercial or industrial area that would have to be on well and septic.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to kind of push into this topic if we could. I think it's the issue of eminent domain, and I think the intent, particularly in demonstrated cases like this, is the big G gets into the issue. You know, there's land that's being developed. We've looked at putting out a future plan to say, hey, this is for public use. This is something that is essential to the economic development of the regional area, and then people who have possession of that automatically say, well, you know, they got to use it, so I'm going to bump up the price. And I think that's going to be a question that we probably need to address here, because it isn't just the big money tree. This is taxpayer dollars. And albeit in this particular case, limited taxpayer dollars with the aviation fund, which does receive a limited amount of funds coming in. Now, if we're talking about the federal government, then you're saying, well, you know, that's an endless pit. Well, that's not an endless pit. I mean, we have limited dollars that we need to use wisely. And so I guess for us it's going to be an interesting proposition to come up and say, you know, what is equitable here?
What does just compensation actually mean? And particularly in a what seems to be a situation here where it's not really clear-cut, as you just pointed out, that the motivations of the landowners relative to the future public use, and yet Representative Beard is pointing out too, well, a taking is a taking, and we need to be concerned about that too. But I would agree with you that the we need to be good stewards of the taxpayers' dollars as we are approaching the increased costs that might accompany some of the proposals that are coming forward now to taxpayers. as taxpayers as opposed to those very same people as property, as private property owners, and there when needs to be a good balance there.
Mr. Town, on the proposed land, and I know this has been in play for a couple of years now because there was the new runway, the end zones that we were talking about, and there were some proposed developments that were taking place, and we're trying to protect those end zone, the B zone, I believe, from a housing development. And I think there was a proposal for the 18-month moratorium on building that kind of gave us a window of protection there. I wonder if you might just make a brief statement about that, if it has any relevance. Also, for the B-zone conditional use, you know, whether or not we have really looked into using, and I say that because I know that at the end of 1735 here at the MAC, we've got some controversy that's going on with International Diesel, I think, which is in the B-zone, which is really a conditional use issue and has really precluded us from having to take them in terms of eminent domain or just taking them, which would set a, to me, would set a poor precedence that I believe would take us down a road we don't want to go. But I wonder if you might comment on those two.
Mr. Towell.
Madam Chair and Representative Severson, yes, first I'll take the moratorium question. We did, as we started this master planning process, we were able to at least enter into at a minimum of a 12-month moratorium with the ability to, I think, tack on an additional 6 months for an ultimate 18-month moratorium for development, or, you know, in close proximity to the airport. There was a while this was going on, there was a plat that was being brought forward to the city of St. Cloud in some of this orderly annexation that was taking place just northwest of the airport in a PUD planned unit development. And we were able to hold that off for quite some time, and ultimately in this planning process realized that, you know, even in a worst case scenario, this residential development was going to be far enough away from the airport where it was not going to impact this 55 DNL or day night level average. It's a decibel level. They go out in rings from the airport. And so it was not even an impact of 55. My understanding is that the FAA, they basically realized the 65 level decibel, and after that they end up not wanting to participate. So ultimately, we would have had to have purchased the developable rights of that land because it was already zoned, the PUD, or allow it to take place, and the city of St. Cloud opted to allow that to take place. Granted, it was able to stop other plats from coming forward and other annexation processes from coming forward as well. So that was very helpful. In terms of Zone B use, we do have some compatible Zone B uses taking place right now. We've got what we call an airport business park to the northwest of the airport, right on centerline. It's a compatible land use in that it will be mostly industrial office space. Typically, they don't complain about noise because they're creating noise themselves, and it's going to be located in Zone B. I'm working with the City of St. Cloud, the Area Planning Organization, and some others to ensure that the right types of development take place in there as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Tall, you mentioned in here about 1976, the City of St. Cloud and the three counties get together to put together a master plan or some type of a agreement between them on what on how the regional airport should be developed. The master plan now is 30 years old, 1976. How often do you update that plan? How often do these three, four entities get together? And the new mayor now that's on board, Mayor Kleiss, is he a part of that group of planners? And how does he feel about what's going on?
Mr. Tell.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, the new mayor, Mayor Kleiss, is already an integral part of this process, even though we are almost completed with it. The old mayor was able to pass on his information. I've updated the new mayor on exactly what's taking place. In terms of the master plans, The first master plan was done in the late 70s, and the last one was done in the year 2000. The FAA likes to see them updated typically every 5 to 10 years or so, depending on the situation. Ours was updated in 2000, and we've already, as you know, are in the process of completing another update due to the growth and some other factors that have taken place. In what you're recalling here from my statements in 1976, that was actually the zoning ordinance. Now, that zoning ordinance was taken off of that master plan. That master plan actually had the foresight to look at a 7,000-foot runway at St. Cloud Municipal Airport. And so we didn't need to update that or redo that zoning ordinance until now with this new master plan. It's now calling for an 8,000-foot runway. It's calling for a crosswind runway of in the neighborhood of 6,400 feet. But I think the big one is going to be a future parallel. When you look 20 years out, that the growth of the corridor between St. Cloud and the Twin Cities, ultimately this study talks about St. Cloud becoming the second largest airport in the state of Minnesota. If all that takes place, we're going to need a second runway out there, and that's now increased the footprint of the airport as well.
Senator Youngbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, as we're kind of digressing into eminent domain, I just kind of wanted to bring everybody back on track of what happened in eminent domain. As a former mayor, we use it for roads. Eminent domain's proper use is to gather land for a public purpose. The Kelo case, the main problem with that was the court basically blessed it and said, you can take private land and then reconvey it to another private entity for a private use. And that is the big issue in eminent domain today, is the taking of land for a greater tax base or for another private use. And that, in my opinion, is an improper use of eminent domain. And that's, so we have to be careful how we look at those things, because there are public uses, airports, roads, that we need to keep eminent domain intact for that. But I certainly disagree with the taking of private land to reconvey it to another private owner for a purpose that is not consistent with the community.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments or questions for Mr. Cowell? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Appreciate your testimony. Now I'd like to welcome Mr. Harold Van Leeuwen from Bemidji.
Thank you.
I didn't see Harold today.
Is he present? Then we'll move on to Mr. Ray Strege, consultant for Fort Elliott Hendrickson.
Madam Chair, we were late in getting in because of airline connections. I did have a handout prepared, and we weren't here before the start of the meeting, so we'd like to pass this out.
We'll get it. We'll get it from you, sir, and I do need to ask you to identify yourself for the benefit of the tape, and also other testifiers, if you had not done so, at the conclusion of the hearing, if you would come back and sign in on the clipboard that's at the desk, and I would ask those who are testifying now to do the same.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Ray Strege from Short Elliott Hendrickson, a principal with the firm, and with me is Joe Boyle, the International Falls Coochin County Airport Commission attorney, and he's also the city engineer.
City attorney, Greater Show Falls.
Correct.
Welcome to
he's an engineer.
Welcome to our meeting, Mr. Boyle. Well.
Thank you. Compatibility of airports in the area surrounding them have been a challenge for many years. In the 1950s and 60s, airport relocations occurred because the airports were squeezed out by the development that occurred around them. In 1970, the Congress passed the Airport and Airways Development Act, and that act enabled federal funding of airport master plans. Due to the experience that the Minnesota had with the closing and relocation of airports, the Minnesota Department of Aeronautics felt that long-term airport planning was essential to the state system of airports. It created a new position for an airport master plan coordinator, and I was hired to fill that position in 1972. The master plan identified the needs for development for each of these airports for a 20-year period. Land acquisition was identified, and typically the master plan would indicate that land acquisition needed for the next 20 years should be acquired upfront as soon as possible. The 1973 legislature felt that too much money was being spent on land acquisition and not enough on capital improvements. So as a condition to the 2004-2005 biennium appropriations was the requirement that airports must be zoned or in the process of zoning to receive state, and because of the federal funds having to go through the state aeronautics, also federal funds. A couple days after the legislature adjourned, there was a meeting of the staff of the Department of Aeronautics. At that time, as I remember, the department was the smallest department in Minnesota state government, 30 people. So we got about a dozen people together and sat down to discuss how to develop model airport land zoning. And the conversation went something like this. Was decided, first of all, we want to keep it as simple as possible. There is different needs for levels of control around the airport. Let's identify these different levels with 1, 2, 3, ABC. The ABC stuck. For some reason, the 1959 guidance and model was not taken into account that time. We started with a clean sheet of paper. At that point, the suggestion was made as far as the approaches, that's the most critical. Let's relate it to something that's easy to visualize, and at first was the runway length. Let's relate that to the runway length, and then our suggestion was, as long as we have the master plans, let's relate it to the ultimate length of the runways. Next comment was, when the aircraft is close to the runway, either landing or taking off, the destiny kind of determines where the airplane comes down. If there's an engine failure on a single engine, or even on a twin, whereas when the aircraft is a little further out, the pilot has some discretion as to where that aircraft is going to come down. So if we have some open spaces in the area further out, that will create an additional level of safety. So those zones A and B created from that, and the comment was, well, let's make it 50-50. That evening, as I was wiping dishes with my wife, I was thinking about what had occurred, and at that time, 3,000 feet was about the shortest runway that Minnesota was participating in, and the clear zones were 2,000 feet long, so the 50-50 formula didn't work with the short runways, so I thought 2/3, 1/3 works, so the next day we had a second meeting and talked about the 50-50 versus 2/3, 1/3. So 2/3, 1/3 was decided as what should be the standard or the model. So the department at that time was very small. It was very simple. It was not a very sophisticated determination of a model ordinance, and it certainly was not a case where the model came down as etched in stone from the mountaintop. As far as the 2/3, 1/3 was concerned, what was in hand was a dish towel. So it did take about a year for the concept to finally get established into a model of zoning, many iterations, but the basic concept was still the same as what was decided over a 24-hour period. The requirement for the zoning was then distributed to the airport owners and the airport zoning boards, and ordinances were adopted based upon the model ordinance. And at this time, I'd like to have Joe Boyle describe what happened at the local levels as they adopted these ordinances.
Mr. Boyle.
Thank you. My name is Joseph Boyle, and I'm an attorney. Long ago, back in 1973, I actually just passed the bar, and this file was thrown on my desk about airport zoning and helping the airport zoning, because my predecessor was the city attorney at the time, and I was just the assistant city attorney. One of the things that in International Falls was upsetting about, as we were looking over the airport zoning law that was the model zoning law, was although there was an insistence back in the 70s of a 3-acre minimum lot size, we had a 2.5-acre minimum lot size. And at least at that time, and everyone was growing in the process, at least originally Department of Transportation didn't want to consider anything other than a 3-acre minimum lot size, because that's what was on the form. However, working with our state representative, who happens to be still around these days, Irv Anderson and other people with the Department of Transportation, we eventually were able to get a 2.5-acre minimum lot size adopted and accepted by the Department of Aeronautics. They also made a couple of other minor modifications, and as a result of that, as we went to enforce our ordinance, we had a slightly different ordinance than the model ordinance. Back in the 80s or early 80s, there was land that was considered marketable, and some of that land was in what we call the B-zone, and this, of course, minimum lot size was also in the B-zone. At the time, we also had a substantial amount of land in the A-zone. However, there had been funding whereby we had adopted a policy whereby as soon as a landowner wished to have his land acquired, they would notify us, and within a reasonable period of time, that was our policy, we would acquire the land, which has been and is our policy. Mr. Strigge has referred to it as a friendly neighbor policy, and that's actually somewhat worked in International Falls. In any event, because of the McShane case, which I'm sure everyone's aware of, but basically it talks about the principle one of the members of the committee was just talking about, that where there is a public governmental enterprise, there must be compensation where there is any kind of a substantial and measurable diminution in market value for the property owner. And what happened in our particular case is there was a property owner who was challenging our ordinance, and we were successful. And the only thing that was sort of unique about us is that in the Keenan case that went to the Court of Appeals, that particular lawyer had won 22 cases in a row, and this is the first one that he lost. And some of the reasons why he lost are the same factors that you folks are talking about today. There was a mention also by a committee member about market value. I don't think that you can, on a committee, determine market value. The case law is basically a decision. One of the good things about what our courts have said is that it has to be based upon real factors, just not mere expert testimony, but based upon factors where the expert has to have some substantial basis. And in any event, we won our case because although the property owner alleged that there was a large market, there really wasn't a large market. He wasn't able to establish a substantial diminution in value, and so our ordinance was considered enforceable. And it was enforceable, number one, because we did deviate, because the Department of Aeronautics had deviated from the 3-acre minimum lot size to a 2.5-acre minimum lot size. And number two, because we had this ongoing policy of acquiring land in the A-zone. I think it's very important that the Department of Aeronautics funds the land acquisition for to the extent there's any kind of a diminution in value due to zoning, whether it be in the A-zone where you may have to acquire fee simple, or or other types of uses or easements. The only thing is that if you don't do that, although everyone's scared of the words eminent domain, the fact is that it just costs the taxpayers a lot more money. The sooner you fund it and the more you deal with it, if you are dealing with an existing land that really is agricultural, better to acquire that land before it turns out to be something else. It seems like there's all sorts of agricultural land between, say, St. Cloud and not between St. Cloud and International Falls, but St. Cloud and the Twin Cities that is changing in values, but they're not changing overnight, and the sooner acquired, the better off you'd be. I don't know if that answers.
Comments or further testimony? Mr. Strayton.
Madam Chair, members, airport zoning by itself will fail in the long run. If there needs to be the airport owner's financial ability to acquire property rights as a backing for the zoning ordinance. International Falls was successful in defending their ordinance because they did have this backing. From a public policy standpoint, it's certainly a good idea that airports not force landowners into inverse condemnation situations. Zoning can be protective, but it's not corrective. Land acquisition can be both protective and corrective, but it's more costly. A combination of the two is needed. George Santayana said that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And the lessons we learned from 30 years ago, I hope we do remember, and that we not try to control incompatible uses around airports strictly by zoning. We have the financial mechanisms to compensate landowners by a formal purchase of the property rights in those cases where they do want to be relocated. In many cases, in the case of International Falls, for a period of the last 30 years, once every 2-3 years, a landowner in Zone A will come forward and ask to be purchased. It's a good deal for the property owner in that they can stay at their home or business if it's not in a critical location for as long as they want. When it's time for them to move on because of a job change or downsizing due to retirement or whatever it is, there's a ready buyer, and the Uniform Act requires the governmental entity to provide relocation costs, fair compensation. So it works for the airport because there is not the need for major land acquisition right up front. It can be distributed in some cases over decades, and for the landowner it works for them because they can they know they have a ready buyer. As a footnote, many times Minnesota Aeronautics Office has participated in the cost of land acquisition, but any discussion we have of their participation at this time is sort of academic because the state airports fund has pretty much dried up, so this isn't the correct day to discuss it, but we definitely have to have some discussion on what's occurred as a result of the $15 million transfer from the state airports fund to the general fund, the $5 million that's been lost because of the airline bankruptcies, and also there's probably, well, there's in excess of $1 million that's been lost to the fund due to the interest on the money that was in the fund that's no longer there. So we certainly appreciate your taking the time to listen to what we have to say, and if there's any questions, we'll try to answer that.
Are there questions or comments for Mr. Strage or Mr. Boyle at this time? Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Strage. Just your comments on the scientific method that you determined.
Representative Severson, you need to bring your microphone down.
Thank you. I was just saying the scientific method that was used to determine the two-thirds, one-third was kind of like the way aviation used to be, kick the tires, light the fires, take off, and if you come back, you're in good shape. But I was wondering if in recent studies that you have used some of the NTSB numbers in terms of commercial and private aviation to plot out accident sites within the A and B zone?
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, I have not personally been involved in that. Maybe Minnesota Aeronautics has done that. Typically, I think that would be. But part of the problem is that the database for accidents in aviation is so small compared to, say, ground transportation that it's somewhat difficult to come up with a prediction of where accidents are going to occur. But beyond that, I don't have any personal knowledge of any additional studies.
Madam Chair, I think the issue being is that in this modernization of aviation, we've got increasing performance on airframes, tighter training programs, and it has really facilitated an upward trend in safety in air traffic, particularly in the A and B zones. And I think if we were to look at a trend through the NTSB, you'd see a significant decrease in the numbers of accidents that are taking place. And so I think a review of the size of those zones is really something that would benefit us to say, if we stay where we're at, we're safe. And in the future, we're going to be safer because airplanes are getting safer. And so I guess I would, you know, just say that I think it's kind of a dynamic situation that I think as if we take a look at where we're at and the numbers justify going into a program where we're becoming, you know, trying to make things safer, I think it's going to be self-defeating because I think things are getting safer on their own. Just a little pontification. I apologize.
Anyone else have a comment? Representative Beard.
A brief observation taking off Representative Severson's comment. I wanted Mr. Strege to be here today, particularly so the members could hear just how our definition of A and B actually came into being. The RPZ is pretty sacrosanct because, speaking as a pilot, when things are happening on the takeoff roll or the landing roll, like we saw at Midway, in those few moments, and thankfully there are only a few seconds of time when your exposure and your risk is the highest, that's when you're most out of control in your airplane if something goes wrong. Once you're actually airborne and the plane is cleaned up and flying, that's when space in the A and B becomes important because now you're actually the pilot and you're actually much more in control. And I see the wisdom of having a 2.5 or 3-acre policy in those areas where you can. Because as a pilot, if there's a house sitting in the middle of 3 acres and you hit the house, well, duh. There's a lot of room around it to miss it. And you can actually fly your plane right to the point of impact. In fact, it's one of the things that we pay all that money for training for because we have an instructor sitting in the seat beating us on the head, making sure we're paying attention and do things like keep your wings level, land straight ahead, and miss the house, please. We do those things. And so it's good for us to know where the A, some of the background in the A, where it comes from and what we're actually dealing with. A lot of this is for pilots and for aviation safety, but it's also for the people on the ground. When you don't have houses packed shoulder to shoulder or huge congregations of people in the A zone, it makes it a lot easier to aim for a street or a parking lot or something like that. So I'm glad you're here. There weren't a lot of questions for you, but I hope it was worth the flight to come down, Mr. Boyle.
Yeah,
we're glad you're here and spend a little money on our aviation system today. And, right. And thanks for educating us a bit.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and I'd just like to direct a question to Council because it's its last day, and I think it's appropriate that we do it, and perhaps to Representative Baird. The discussion I just heard leads me to think that it's kind of close to land banking, what we're talking about. And in highways now, we've got a real problem with that because we can protect a corridor by platting for a short time. There's really some question, how long can you do it? You know, the typical one was down by Chan S. Is that the area down there?
Up border.
Yeah. They kept that corridor for a few years. Now, I don't think we have any statutes that pertain that we can do any land banking for airports, and that's the question I've asked Council. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leader, I am not aware of any statutes that place limitations on the ability of an airport authority or a local unit of government to purchase land in advance of potential airport expansion. But at the same time, I'm not aware of any limitations on their ability to control those uses through platting. I think that it is has probably been done much less frequently with respect to airports than with respect to highways.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Leader.
Probably they can't answer, but I'm kind of curious if there is any land banking going on. Perhaps the other gentleman with the state aviation, or Representative Beard, is there some land banking going on with airports that we're aware of?
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, Representative Leader, that's why I asked you to be on this committee, because you come up with these brilliant ideas every once in a while. And seriously, you know, when I was addressing the what amounted to a de facto taking by not allowing a farmer to upgrade the value of his property through the zoning reapplication process, that's exactly what I was getting at. You're right, though. The Highway 212, 312 corridor, whatever we're calling it, through Chanhassen and Chaska, was protected for years through the planning process, and just everybody knew it. What I'm not familiar with, though, is how those landowners were compensated, but I don't see why we couldn't have that process examined and brought over into this process. It seems to make sense to me, and as we're, Senator Rest and I are on the Land Use Planning Board, we've got some high-paid consultants we can certainly bring that to.
Senator Youngbaugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to kind of correlate with what Representative Beard just said, having been a mayor and been part of some of that land use planning, I have, in point of fact, seen landowners do exactly what we're talking about. It works on both sides, where they try to change the zoning just so they can get more money when they know a project's going through. So you need to be careful, and you need to look at all the issues. And I can take a couple of real simple ones in East Bethel, where we planned for road upgrade projects, where we turned old dirt roads basically into some nice upgraded asphalt roads, and the owners petitioned to not have an assessment for that road, stating they'd never sell the property and they just wanted to live there forever. And it was, lo and behold, within the first 3 months after that nice asphalt was there, they sold to the most expensive developers they could find, and then, of course, they didn't want us to go backwards and assess the property. So they got, in a couple cases, people got all the value of what the city and the rest of the taxpayers put in with none of the money of what should have been the difference. They should have paid the assessment because it did, in fact, increase the value of their property. In a couple of cases, they didn't, and as a city, we did change our ordinances to protect that from happening. But it does work on both sides. There's people that cheat the system on both sides, so I agree 100% in just compensation, but if this, I don't know what's going on out in St. Cloud there, but if somebody's trying to rezone in the middle of nowhere just to make their land of more value and it doesn't make sense to have a commercial development out there, we need to look at both sides and say, yeah, something weird's going on here, but we do need to protect both ends of that process.
Are there any other comments? Mr. Strege?
Madam Chair, a couple additional comments here. First of all, every airport is different, and therefore each airport's zoning needs to be considered on an individual basis. When the zoning model was put together in 73, we specifically mentioned Old Chamberlain, as Minneapolis-St. Paul International used to be referred to back then, that we aren't going to try to find one model that fits the 3,000-foot runway and the and something the size of Old Chamberlain.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, too, I think there was a question that came up earlier on Midway, and just comparing the airports in Minnesota that handle the 737 DC-9-type aircraft, the runways there are Rochester, for instance, I think they're Crosswind runway, 7,500 feet, 1,000 feet longer. Duluth is 9,000 feet. MSP is 10,000 feet. So in those cases, that the aircraft would not have even got off the end of the runway. So Minnesota has, over many, many years, put together a good system of airports, and I hope we can continue that into the years to come. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Members, Senator Youngbaugh had an issue that he brought to the attention of Representative Beard.
And one other thing I'd like to just point out.
And before I turn to him to comment on that, is the perhaps Ms. Myers, you could hand out Representative Beard, Senator Youngbaugh's handout. Representative Beard had a comment on air cargo.
Members, in your packet, there is a note from House Counsel Joel Michaels titled Article 10, International Economic Development Zone. At the last meeting we had on January 31st, there was a question a member had, and I can't recall who it was, asking for some further information. This is what happens when you ask for those things. The answers come out, and this is the what staff provided for us. So that is what Article 10, the International Economic Development Zone packet, is about. That's in your information today. It's an answer to a question that a member asked on January 31st.
And actually, also, too, it is the House research summary from the omnibus tax bill that was passed.
Yes.
And it was indeed Article 10 of the tax bill. So he's just providing us with the summary of that. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I just wanted to make the members aware of an issue that somebody brought before me concerning the Metropolitan Airport Commission. A person applied to have an air show at the Bear Lake Airport and was turned down by MAC, and I don't know that these things go through a formal application process. And I talked to Mitch Killian about this and several actual projects that have gotten turned down by MAC, and in our conversation with Mr. Killian, it occurred to me that it seemed like MAC was telling him about all the real bad propositions, but didn't seem to be informing him of things that appeared to be good. I just wanted to let you know on this one, having read Commissioner Lanner's last report on the reliever airports, and the consensus has been that reliever airports need to do things to come up with more money and to be paying more of their operation and maintenance costs and things. And this particular air show, these air shows, I wanted to give you the whole packet because they do go on in every major city in the United States in the same types of airspace that we have around Minneapolis, St. Paul. And the cover letter here talks about a minimum of $25,000 in the 1.5% fee to MAC. Actually, the Association of Competitive Air Show Pilots and Mr. Fiorello of Aircraft Resource Center feel that that's a low fee and that MAC's take on a air show like this should be around $50,000. It seems to me we ought to be looking at these kind of things. They're great for our local economy. It's a good moneymaker for MAC towards the cost of the reliever airports. It's obviously a great promotion tool for the general aviation community. You know, I know when I was a kid and we had all these air shows around Minnesota, that was what gave me my wonder of flight and just you know, made me think about always wanting to be a pilot, which I still always want to be a pilot, even though I've owned a plane for 5 years. I don't have my pilot's license. It's kind of a weird deal. Representative Severson talked about the upward trend in safety, and there's issues addressed in here over the safety that I think they have a 52-year history of no injuries at any of these air shows. And if we're going to have an air show, the particular airport that we're talking about, Air Lake, is surrounded by mostly agricultural land, so if indeed you were worried about safety and things, this is precisely the type of area where you'd want something, so you're not dealing with a great residential area. So I'm actually working with the governor's office to see what we can do about this, but I thought that I'd like to bring this to the committee so that you understood there are proposals like this that, from my time in the Senate, seem to get turned down all the time by MAC, and in point of fact, they keep saying on one side of the mouth, well, we want more money, and on the other side, well, gee, we're worried about safety issues, and we got to turn this down. So we need to look at these things, and basically, I'm trying to make you aware of it.
Thank you very much, Senator Jungbauer. Are there any other comments or questions of him? Seeing none. We appreciate the attendance from the audience of interest in these issues that are in the jurisdiction of this, both of these subcommittees, and appreciate the attendance of members, and no further business, we are adjourned.
Thank you. See y'all at John Williams' party at 2 o'clock.
This is official last committee.
How about that?
We're witnessing this people
now. We are.
Dog voting.
Well,